This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news and political news here on WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266. And if you're on Facebook today, or even if you're not, it's pretty easy to get on. You can find us on Facebook Live today. There's pictures of us doing everything that we're doing, which is basically just talking into microphones, with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us for the first time is Caitlin Krassel. She's political reporter for Hearst Connecticut Media. Welcome, Caitlin. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Mark Pazniokas. He's Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org. Hello there, Paz.
Hello. Caitlin and I were just talking about how she thought Colin would be taller.
She thought Colin would be taller.
She's already met me twice.
Yeah.
So that's
why aren't
and
you taller?
And she still thought you'd be taller.
I know.
Why aren't you taller since the last
time? You
thought
I'd have a growth spurt since the Democratic Convention.
Yeah.
The Democratic Convention has that influence on people.
Well, we
sometimes.
Are a little squashed and compressed.
Exactly. Well, let's get a little update on where we are with the governor's race right now. And Paz, we've been following this for the last couple of weeks. Let's get, first of all, to who's going to be on the ballot. We've finally got some people confirmed. They've gotten enough signatures so that they will be on the August ballot. Who's now on?
On the Republican side, we now know what the field is. And it's a big one. It'll be a five-way primary because David Stemmerman qualified yesterday. His signatures were certified. Bob Stefanowski got his ticket to the primary on Monday, and they will join the three Republicans who made it at the convention, Mark Boughton, Tim Herbst, and Stephen Obsitnik.
Okay, so it, what are
oh,
we—
Oh, okay, yeah. Yes, let's not leave out Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim because he also got his signature certified yesterday. So there will indeed be at least a two-way Democratic primary, Ned Lamont and Joe Ganim. Guy Smith, his petitions, signatures are still being counted, so he may or may not make it.
So we now have this field starting to come together. I don't know. What are we learning, Caitlin, about any of these candidates? We now know that Stemmerman, Stefanowski, have the ability to go out and canvass for a certain number of petitioning signatures. We figured Joe Ganim would get them because he was doing an awful lot of work in the cities. But are we hearing anything else from these candidates other than, okay, now I'm on the ballot?
I think you're starting to get a sense of who they are as a person now that they are out there. They're less focused on gathering those signatures, so they're able to talk more about the issues as well as really just appeal to voters who will be at the primary.
And as we think about appealing to voters and finding out a little bit more about these people, Colin Maine, I don't know. I'm still not entirely clear other than the fact that Bob Stefanowski was able to get on the ballot and get access a little sooner than David Stemmerman. How he's differentiating himself from his other big spending self-funder from that part of the state?
Whose name begins with S? Okay, well, you can start with money. This only just sort of sunk in with me recently. But one of them has like a lot of money, and then the other one has like rock star money. So Bob Stefanowski is a very wealthy guy. David Stemmerman is probably considerably more wealthy. Like maybe, I mean, one thing that's hard for those of us who spend our lives in journalism, and I'm sorry to bring this home to you, newcomer to our show, but there's a big difference between between a net worth of $17 million and $170 million. I'm just making these numbers up. These aren't the numbers for those two guys. But it's hard for us to grasp that because $17 million seems like a lot of money. but Stemmerman probably has quite a bit more money. He in terms of self-funding, what he can do, you know, it'd probably be a little bit more analogous to what we saw Linda McMahon do. I mean, it may be kind of a bottomless supply of money. He also seems to be putting together a pretty effective team. And he runs a very kind of ideas-oriented campaign. Now, some of the ideas don't necessarily pass muster. There's been some questions about whether his transportation plan is particularly viable. But it's kind of a dreamy transportation plan. I think Stefanowski's kind of defining himself much more as a 1980s Republican. His commercial is very much about being a 1980s Republican. There's pictured is Ronald Reagan and Arthur Laffer, who is Stefanowski's advisor, but the inventor of the Laffer curve, which drove a lot of the Reagan era policies and which most economists don't believe actually works. But I see him a little – they're running kind of as different guys now. To your point, Caitlin, we're starting to see these aren't the same guys at all. And I think my analysis is that Stemmerman's a little bit more like Dr. Emmett Brown in Back to the Future, and Stefanowski's more like Lex Luthor.
Anyone want to pick up on that?
Bob Stefanowski has a great head of hair, yes. I wish to say. He does not look at all like Lex Luthor. Some other differences, and this is gets into the horse race stuff, but Stefanowski has put together a pretty impressive campaign. I mean, he's imported a bunch of guys from Virginia who know how to play real hardball. His petitioning campaign was textbook. People at the Secretary of State's office tell me that the rejection rate, you know, was incredibly small. I mean, these guys had a good plan. They executed it. And so far, he, in the private polling that people have shown me, and this is not, I'm not talking about Stefanowski's polling, I'm talking about other campaigns. I mean, he clearly is in lead at this point because he's been on TV since the end of January. Now, a lead in a five-way primary race in June does not mean a hell of a lot because people are just now, most normal people are just now starting to tune in. And things should change rapidly. I mean, we have three other candidates who are seeking public financing that they still have not been accepted yet. That could happen as early as today for at least some of them. And then that will stir the pot when they'll have some money to spend.
Well, and I want to just put a pin in that and come back to the citizens election funding question in just a second. But Caitlin, aside from them trying to, you know, stand out a little bit, express a little bit more who they are as candidates. Are you hearing from voters? Are you hearing from any Republicans or people watching this race of what they're looking for, what they might be asking candidates, maybe specifically Republican candidates who want to change the course of the state? I mean, what are people looking for from what you're reporting in a gubernatorial candidate this year?
They're definitely looking for something that is different than what is currently in Hartford. And whether that's a Democrat or a Republican, they are, I mean, I moved to the state 3 years ago, and from the minute I got here, all I've heard about is how people are fed up with Dan Malloy and Hartford. So I think voters are really focused on what's going to be going into their pocket at the end of the day and who is going to be able to deliver a plan to really fix what they perceive are the big problems in Connecticut.
But that could mean a lot of things in terms of the Republican Party right now, Colin. There's different factions of the Republican Party. Like you say, sort of an 80s Republican. Maybe there's a different sort of thing that's a Stemmerman Republican. And then there's an entire Trump wing, which doesn't seem to be embodied by anybody in this race right now, but has a foothold not only here in the state, but all across the country.
Yeah. So I think Caitlin's absolutely right about how people feel. They want something that doesn't exist, essentially. They want probably a Democrat who will govern like a Republican, something along those lines. There are a lot of people who are uncomfortable voting for a Republican in this cycle. They're not happy with Trump. They're not. I mean, this is Connecticut. So they're, you know, in unaffiliated voters who will decide this election the way they decide every election in Connecticut. You know, they're a little less comfortable, I think, with the Republican brand nationally than they ordinarily would be. So they may have some problems with that. On the other hand, they're, as she says, very unhappy with how they see things going up in Hartford. Now, one thing that passes is really important, which is, you know, people who listen to The Wheelhouse are obviously very interested in politics and they're following all this kind of stuff. And either that or, I don't know, you're just like chained to a wall and you can't
they
get away.
I don't can't get up and change the channel.
I don't know. But I'm assuming if you're listening to this, you care about this stuff. But there's a huge universe out there of really low information voters. There are people who will be voting in these primaries on August 14th who at the moment don't know that Dan Malloy isn't running for governor again. I mean, that kind of lack of understanding about what's going on. So in terms of parsing the difference between Boughton, Herbst, Upsitnik, Stefanowski, Stemmerman, the training wheels haven't even been put on, never mind taken off.
And Paz, what about that? I mean, what do you expect Republican voters specifically are going to be looking for in this sort of mess of trying to understand what the Republican Party is all about, trying to get someone who's not Dan Malloy, but someone who's going to work at the state capitol? I mean, as an example, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, very much not a Trump Republican, the most popular governor in the entire country. He keeps coming out against some traditional Republican plans and or proposals. And in this very blue state, he seems to be doing very well for himself. Is that what Connecticut voters are looking for?
I'll also point out that in Massachusetts, 30% of their convention delegates at the Republican convention abandoned Governor Baker to support an anti-gay marriage guy who has like $20,000 to spend. So I guess my point is people come to these things with a different list of priorities and desires. So you can break it down simply of one of the first cuts is outsider, insider. We keep hearing that. You will hear it until you are ready to vomit this year, insider, outsider. People who have electoral experience, people who don't. So far, that's how people are framing this. To Caitlin's point, people desiring for change, absolutely. The pattern in history is when there's an open seat in Connecticut, it generally flips from one party to the other. It's not an absolute, but that's one of the dynamics that tends to be here. And of course, the X factor is the president of the United States and to what extent he is mobilizing the Democratic base, as well as getting unaffiliated to say, I'm not sure I want to go for a Republican this time.
I want to ask you to elaborate a little bit on what you said about the elections funding, because we still don't have any of the candidates of either party who are able to get this election funding. On the Democratic side, people aren't really necessarily seeking that for various reasons. But on the Republican side, still waiting for these grants. This is kind of a big deal in terms of how they're able to run their campaigns. Why the holdup? Is this taking too long?
The staff of the State Elections Enforcement Commission has been cut by about 40% in the last few years, and that has had an impact on how quickly they can process this stuff. The public financing program has become incredibly popular. You know, we focus on the top of the ballot for governor, but really almost every competitive state legislative race, people in both parties go for and eventually get the public financing. So it's a huge volume of paperwork. They literally have auditors going through every application because it's public money that's being handed out. In the case of a campaign for governor, the primary grant is $1.35 million. In the general, it's $6.5 million. So you get audited. And each contribution comes in with a document where people basically are attesting that they are who they are, they live where they live, they're not a state contractor, they are above the age of 12. By the way, if you're 12 or 13, you can write a check for your favorite candidate, even though you can't vote until you're 18. Kind of a little quirky thing. I'm sure there are a lot of 12-year-olds out there listening to this show right now. I'm going to be delighted to know that.
Stemmer mania is big amongst the 12-year-old crowd. But this, Caitlin, this money is important, especially, you know, when we talk about the candidates who we haven't mentioned yet. You know, Mark Boughton, the mayor of Danbury, a presumed front runner here, and obviously the candidate that was chosen at the party's convention. We haven't been talking about him as much because we've been talking about these self-funding candidates who are going out and getting these petition drives and don't have to worry about getting this money.
Yeah. It's funny that you bring up Mark Boughton. I actually find him really interesting in terms of campaigning. He, of course, is a mayor. He's an active mayor. He's running a city. And he's also very active on Twitter. And we talk about TV ads and how much are people really watching those. But he is someone who comes across very well on Twitter. He is interacting with all of his voters in Danbury. And at the same time, he's out campaigning. So he at least gives the appearance of being an active mayor who is paying attention to the issues in his city at the same time as he's out campaigning. And so you don't need money to be on Twitter.
Colin, can we just talk about that for a second? Because we do always talk about the money being so very important. And there is a question about how much the money that's going to go into these television ads is really going to help get the voters that we need to get as people are, you know, consuming media in all sorts of different ways.
Right. Caitlin's making a great point. And Boughton mastered Twitter very, very early. I mean, he's a Twitter native kind of. However, I would also say that probably younger people get their impressions from Twitter more than older people. Older people vote more than younger people. So that may somewhat militate against that advantage. You know, look, ultimately, long-term, long-haul TV commercials don't make much difference. When it's really been analyzed by political scientists, the answer really is how much difference does a TV ad make? Not that much. But we're in an unusual situation here where you've got a lot of people running for the same office and most of them are unknowns. So why, to Paz's point, is Bob Stefanowski in the lead right now? Well, unlike Upsitnik and Boughton and Herbst, he's got money to spend. He's got money to spend to do commercials, to introduce himself to the public. The other advantage that he and Stemmerman have, and you never know how much of an advantage it is, but if you're running around or you've got people running around with clipboards, getting people to sign their names on your piece of paper, you know, I mean, they at least see your name. They see your name and that they know they signed a piece of paper. And you know how you're trying to decide who to root for in the latest World Cup game and you think, well, geez, my physical therapist is from Colombia. Yeah, maybe I'll root for her. I'll root for, yeah, Colombia. Go Colombia. Well, it's kind of like that sometimes. Like, what do I know about any of these candidates? Well, I did sign that one guy's piece of paper. So I guess I have a really strong bond with him.
So Stefanowski's campaign yesterday, they were taking all of the data they collected from the petition drive and they were putting it into a database, to your point exactly. Remember, in a five-way race, the winner could end up with 24,000 votes.
That's 100,000 people probably will vote.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
And so if you can, you know, of the 15,000 or so signatures he collected, he needed fewer to qualify. It was just a little north of 9,000. If you can convert half of them into your voters, that's a hell of a head start. Caitlin, to your point about Boughton and tweeting, his most recent tweet, however, I will point out, is a picture of the lawn signs which have arrived. So the old school stuff still seems to get some attention.
Well, I think he's toned down the stuff about the Bachelorette and
the Walking Dead
and all that stuff. I think it's like, you know, a little bit he's trying to have a little bit more gravitas.
He does have 37,000 followers, almost 38,000. So again, in a small world, if he can get any significant percentage of them out, it'll help.
I like the idea of taking pictures of the lawn signs and putting them on Twitter. That way you don't have to buy as many lawn signs.
We should just quickly say
they're very expensive.
In terms of this money, so the people who are really being deprived right now at the gubernatorial level, it's Upsitnik and Herbst and Boughton. All right, they're still waiting for their grants. The agency that does all this is meeting in about 10 minutes from now. They might get their money then. But there's also a lot of down ticket people who are still waiting. For example, you know, all those AG candidates, of which there are many. There are all the people running statewide races who are trying to get citizens' elections grants don't have them now. None of them have them. If you're running in some rinky-dink, not to say it's rinky-dink, but if you're running for a House or a Senate race, you've got a better chance of having your grant right now.
Name a town for me. When you say rinky-dink, name a town.
Higginham is one.
Good, perfect. Now we'll get phone calls. Thank you so much. Actually, we've got a phone call right now. Before we take a break, let's just get to Ryan, who's calling from Woodbridge. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Yeah, hey, guys. I want to talk about, you were talking about the differences between some of the candidates. I think a main difference is people don't have plans. Ned Lamont keeps saying he wants an honestly balanced budget, not on the backs of teachers and the unions. But he hasn't gave any specifics on how he's going to balance that budget. And same with like Upsitnik and Boughton, they say they're going to grow the state, but they haven't really given any specifics, and especially Mark Boughton on his eliminating the state income tax plan. But what I think is interesting is David Stemmerman's plan. He's just he's down on a mailing, and he has his tax brackets in place. He has a plan for the pensions. So I think that's something that you guys should point out when you're talking about some of the differences.
Hey, Ryan, thank you very much for the phone call. And Caitlin, we talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago when the Stemmerman plan came out. We spent quite some time talking about it because, well, we didn't have anything else to talk about in terms of actual plans. A plan doesn't necessarily mean it's the plan that's going to work for the state, but some voters like Ryan, certainly those of us in the media, are constantly saying, what's your plan? What's your plan? Are you hearing plans from anyone?
I'm not. And I think the reason for that is it's pretty early to put out a plan. And the earlier you put out a plan, the more time you give people to pick it apart.
Let me stop you here. It's pretty early. It's like the end of June of 2018. The election is in 2018. I mean, when are we going to hear the plan? When should we hear the plan?
I mean, I personally would like to hear it sooner rather than later because I want to write about more specifics. I want to know, you know, I can write a million stories about their bullet points, but I want to know the specifics. And I think a lot of voters do.
Yeah, well, when would we typically hear something, Paz? I mean, you've covered an awful lot of these things. I mean, are we expected to have a detailed or even semi-detailed plan of how we're going to solve a problem by mid-June?
I'll tell you exactly when you can see a plan. February of next year, whoever's elected is going to propose a budget to the General Assembly. Look, The dirty secret in all this is if any of these guys put forward a real plan as to how they're going to balance the budget, how they're going to fund transportation, how they're going to deal with the unfunded pension liability, they will be unelectable because the answers to those questions are going to be – are god-awful. They are difficult. Now, some of them are kind of – they're on the edges. They're giving us ideas about an approach. But, you know, David Stemmerman has put out a couple plans that are on his website. But if you look at them, there's a real question about how practical they are. His transportation plan that went up, most of it is a recitation. It makes the case as to why you need to do things, but it doesn't say really how you're going to pay for them. You know, you have lines in there about public-private partnerships, but there really is not granular detail about how you're going to put money back into the special transportation fund, which is what finances all this stuff.
Colin, quick thought?
I would just agree with what I think Stemmerman gets points for putting a plan out there and making people like Caitlin happy. But Paz is also right. When he did it, he kind of exposed to some of us a little bit of his naivete about what he thinks is accomplishable. And particularly that transportation play just has a lot of stuff in it that just – it's really not workable and it's easily exposed. It's not workable. I think the closest thing you're going to see to any kind of plan will emerge either right before or during any kind of protracted debate season, because usually during a debate, you know, people do – at least they are called upon anyway to express some set of policies.
That's Colin McEnroe. He hosts the Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. Mark Pazniokas is Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Caitlin Kresselt is political reporter for Hearst Connecticut Media. When we come back, we're going to talk about the race for Attorney General. We're also going to talk about the big issue in the nation that everyone's talking about, whether or not it's playing into politics right here in Connecticut, what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border. You can join our conversation in the Wheelhouse right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can call us at 860-275-7266 if you want to talk with us about the week's news. We're here with Caitlin Kresselt, who's political reporter for Hearst Connecticut Media, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, and also our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Hold on just a second. The pig is about to eat the burrow. Hold on. I'm sorry. I was looking at my phone. What did you ask me?
I asked you about what's on your show today.
Our show today is about phone addiction. There's an author who's written a book about how to break up with your phone. The notion being that people actually spend more time on their phones than they would tell you they do based on their own sense of how much. And people increasingly, as you know, wake up in the middle of the night to check their phone and leave it by their bedside. So we're going to talk a little bit about to what degree that does resemble an addiction. And also going to mention a program called – do you know about Yonder?
Yeah, I don't know about Yonder.
Yonder is this thing where, like, if you go to a Chris Rock concert, you have to hand your phone over and they put it in this kind of Yonder pouch, which you'll get back at the end of the concert. There's certain situations where in schools and stuff like that, they're trying this program too. Just take your phone away from you, but in a way that's, you know, clear, you'll get it back.
They do that at the Masters Golf Tournament. You have to hand over your phone. You're not allowed to take your cell phone onto the golf course there. That's the only time I didn't know it was called Yonder.
I was about to say something really snarky about the Masters Golf Tournament, but I think I'm
Colin McEnroe is going to be talking about internet addiction and the phone addiction coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock on his program. So let's turn to a race that we haven't really spent very much time at all talking about because there hasn't been anything really exciting happening. So maybe this week, Paz, the race for Attorney General, especially on the Democratic side, is finally now providing a little bit of heat. First of all, Are all the people who are running, are they actually qualified per the Bisewitz rule? You know, what enables you to actually be Attorney General?
Yes, let's move on. No. okay, the Connecticut is an outlier. Connecticut is, as far as I can tell, is the only state in the United States that has qualification lists that are this detailed and also ambiguous. You must have courtroom experience, how much, whatever. I mean, that went before the Connecticut Supreme Court.
Detailed and ambiguous, always a good combination.
Really? I mean, it would be like if you're getting your driver's license. Really, do you want this long discussion? I mean, most other states, there is an age requirement. Some of them have a residency requirement. Some of them require you be a member of the bar, but not all. Here in Connecticut, effectively, there is a 10-year residency requirement because you must be a member of the Connecticut Bar for 10 years. And then there's this ambiguous language about experience, about you have to be a litigator, you have to have courtroom experience. So there are any number of members of the General Assembly who most people would think would be a pretty well-qualified attorney general who at this point cannot run because they're not litigators. It's really a dumb rule. There is a very accomplished federal judge named Alvin Thompson who was the managing partner of Robinson and Cole. He could be accepted as a U.S. District Court judge, but he couldn't have run for attorney general because he was a corporate lawyer. He was not a litigator.
Mm. So, okay, so dumb rule or not, do we have questions about whether or not, say, William Tong is qualified to be attorney general?
The questions are fun for us to raise. But as long as Mr. Tong does not make the mistake of seeking a declaratory judgment, asking if he's okay, he doesn't have anything to worry about. Because one of the interesting things here is nobody else really has legal standing to do that. So in 2010, it was Susan Bicewicz who went to court. Now, we all think of it as the Republicans taking her legs out from beneath her, but it was only after she went to court and the Republicans intervened and had great mischief in taking her off the ballot or preventing her from going forward, I should say. But it's hard to see who could come forward and really make the case.
Well, the questions are being raised, though, Colin, by one of his competitors.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with Paz, though. I think this could be a really, really interesting race. I mean, once they all get their grants, which they don't have. I don't think the qualifications thing is going to enter into it. I think what you're going to see, though, this is one where you really can kind of make a values determination. Like, if you really like, this could be horribly unfair, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you really liked Dick Blumenthal, which most people did, you might probably like Chris Matty. You know, he's probably going to be a similar kind of activist attorney general, going after all kinds of people. You know, I don't know if he'll issue as many press releases. I don't know if anybody ever could. But, you know, they might be a little bit similar. If you liked George Jepsen, maybe like Paul Doyle a little bit better too, you know, a little bit lighter touch on things. Doyle, of course, one of the more conservative members of the Democratic caucus, you know, and I don't really know exactly where Tong fit. I can't compare him to an actual, he's probably a little bit like Carl Agello. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know who he's like. But I mean, here you actually have a discernible choice. I mean, there's ways to be attorney general. And I think these candidates may have very different approaches.
Tong is embracing Blumenthal more than Jepsen. He is saying Blumenthal, Blumenthal, Blumenthal. So yeah. I'm guessing there's some polling, there's some testing that people that in the Democratic primary, certainly, that's a more popular approach. And Tong the other day proposed creation of civil rights division. To what end is unclear other than the fact that it gave him a chance to play off against the Trump administration.
But I think that's important. If it's a little bit squishy what the next governor of Connecticut is going to do, there's all these entrenched problems. There's a lot of different ways in which you lead as governor. The job of attorney general really can be boiled down a little bit to a couple of these paths. And it seems as though this race could be something that provides a little bit more clarity. There is the activist type. And in this environment, the activist attorney general is probably going to spend a lot of time the next couple of years taking on the Trump administration over all sorts of issues, whether or not they've got any standing to do it or not.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The current attorney general, George Jepsen, has consistently come out against the Trump administration. He just signed onto a letter with 20 other AGs from across the country just this week relating to this crisis at the border. So I think that's gonna play a huge factor in what people see in these candidates.
We should also say we're talking as though there's going to be a Democratic attorney general. Well, there actually is a primary on the Republican side.
Well, and to that point, I think this is a bigger issue for the Republicans. So you have a state prosecutor, Susan Hatfield, who was a big supporter of President Trump. She was an early supporter of the president. She was a delegate at the convention. And John Chabon, a former state rep. And if a Republican is elected, or as they campaign, this is going to be a question they'll be faced with over and over and over and over again, because there are so many specific cases where you can ask the question, would you have signed on to this lawsuit? Would you be challenging the Trump administration over its failure or its refusal to stop air pollution from the Midwest that's flowing into the northeastern states? That, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, that is part and parcel of what they'll be doing.
But it's also why, and not to discount the possibility of a Republican attorney general, we haven't had one for a very long time. When was the last time we had one? Does anyone know the last time we had a Republican?
Connecticut Republican Attorney
Connecticut
General.
Republican.
That's like sort of like saying black pickleball player. They're just, it's like, it's it just things just don't go together.
That is so public radio, that joke.
But given that this hasn't happened in a very long time, it seems unlikely because of the fact pattern that Mapaz just laid out that we would have one in this environment. Just the overwhelming number of unaffiliated voters and Democratic voters who probably at the very least don't want to have their attorney general lining up on behalf of the state of Connecticut with the Trump administration on things like separations of families at the border. At the end of the day, it seems incredibly difficult for these people to get through that, Colin.
First of all, I would say to whoever does become the Democratic nominee, just transcribe what he just said and base some of your campaigning on that. Because, yeah, I mean, first of all, Connecticut people, they like having a Blumenthal. They like, I mean, I would say the Blumenthal is kind of like Lassie. You know, it's kind of like, what's wrong, girls? Is there something going wrong at the airport? Well, better go up and do something about it. I mean, they like being protected. They like a guard dog, you know. They like Rin Tin Tin or Lassie or something like that. So I would guess in this environment where that the issues that you just sketched out so nicely are charged up even more, the Democrat has kind of a big advantage.
And the thing to remember about Attorney General, this has only been a full-time job since Joe Lieberman, who, you know, was Lieberman, Blumenthal, now Jepson. So this has been a relatively recent thing. The idea of the attorney general's office being something that anybody would sit and talk about on public radio or anywhere else.
Okay. Well, taking the attorney general's job aside, you've already mentioned, Caitlin, that our current attorney general did sign on to this letter with other states. You've also been talking with other people who are running for statewide office about this issue, the issue that has certainly consumed all of America right now as we turn our eyes to the U.S.-Mexico border, this issue of immigrants coming to the border, some trying to cross illegally, some trying to present themselves for asylum, being detained, being separated from their families, about 2,300 children being held in detention centers right now. Huge questions about what is the reality of the actual Trump policy, what was the reality of the Obama administration policy. With all this, you'd think the candidates who are running for office here in Connecticut would at least be able to say something about how they feel about this.
Yeah, I think you're seeing the fact that we're in primary season play into this still because you have candidates who are very carefully trying to tread this line between appealing to the very conservative. And this is particularly on the Republican side. They're trying to appeal to this very conservative, or not at least alienate this very conservative faction of their base, which there is a very conservative part. And also not completely turn off voters, those unaffiliated voters who are going to be voting in the general election. And so you have these candidates coming forth with these statements that are like, yeah, it's bad to separate children from their parents, but they won't come out and say it needs to stop right now. And that's because they're still walking this fine line.
And you've been asking all these campaigns and just really nothing coming out of them.
No, I mean, they'll all say, you know, I don't want to be separated from my children.
That's not really on the table.
We need legislation. Exactly. You know, we need legislation that gets rid of this law that, you know, there is a statute that's been on the books for decades that no one's really enforced until now, until the zero tolerance policy came out. But the fact that they're trying to appeal to both factions, not necessarily trying to appeal, but they're trying not to at least alienate people right now, is producing these really just canned statements that don't really say anything.
But, you know, and we've said this before, Joe Ganim doesn't necessarily have the same canned statement as every other candidate. He's the only one who's actually talked about being separated from his kids because, you know, that actually happened to him.
Yeah. Joe Ganim gave a very emotional appeal in this case. And he, I think, is interesting because when he in 2015, when Trump first started running, he was like, oh, you know, I've met him before through the, you know, the possibility of a casino in Bridgeport, you know, give him a chance. And he's totally flipped. He's using this appeal based on the fact that he was separated from his children. He's definitely not shying away from the fact that he was in prison.
Well, and again, even on immigration policy, Ganim in the past has sided with the Trump administration. He doesn't want Bridgeport to be a sanctuary city, so-called, in part because he doesn't want to risk any sort of federal funding or crackdown from the administration. So in this way, this is Joe Ganim even turning a bit, Paz, on what he said previously about Trump and his immigration policy.
He's looking at the Democratic primary vote. This is a no-brainer. You go as hard as you can against this. There's no downside in the Democratic primary. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of deep thought here about how he's changed. It's an easy play in a Democratic primary.
I'm reminded what Tim McCarver, as an announcer, once said about some pitcher who was up at the plate just flailing in his turn at bat. He described that as approach as swing hard in case you hit it. And I think that's Ganim's approach. I mean, you might as well swing hard. You are obviously operating at a disadvantage based on your personal history and the fact that the Democratic machine is going to line up heavily with Lamont. So you might as well go for it. You know, whatever position you take, you kind of want to get outside of Lamont somehow and really make a distinction between yourself and him that would be, as Pat says, meaningful to that primary audience.
And Joe knows how to get attention.
Yes.
Unlike Ned Lamont, he will say strong things. He understands the media. He will reach out to the media. He knows how to needle Ned Lamont. He knows how to get attention. And when you don't have a whole lot of money to spend because he's barred from the public financing program because of his criminal conviction, it's going to be something of a guerrilla campaign, and that's what we're seeing with, you know, this issue and a bunch of others.
I did, however, read his statement about being separated from his children, being painful, as somewhat unusual. I suppose, Caitlin, the political point he was trying to make, but what he's saying is, I was separated from my children because I went to jail, because I did something wrong. And in that way, it somewhat undercuts perhaps a larger Democratic point that the folks who are coming to the border are fleeing a really terrible situation. I mean, the people being separated from the kids at the U.S.-Mexico border ain't Joe Ganim. They didn't take any money from anybody while they were running their town. They're trying to escape bad situations back home. Kind of a different thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And he did go on to say that, you know, his situation, while he can empathize with being separated from your children, his situation is very different in that his children, you know, there was no real suffering aside from being separated from their parent. They had a lot of other family around. They, you know, are still in their home. You know, it's not the same situation. And he didn't really hedge that.
Let's just say it. It's a really bad analogy or comparison. You know, yeah. I mean, at the border, you got little kids who have seen those photos that, you know, somebody comes up and says, we're going to take your kid for a bath, and then they don't see them for a few weeks. And the kid is freaked out. You have pediatricians talking about the impact of that. That's a far different situation than the separation of somebody leaving in a way that's planned, perhaps not desired.
Not by him.
Not by him.
Well, I think also this might be a slight miscalculation by Joe in the sense that this is a very effective strategy running in Bridgeport, because there's a lot of people in Bridgeport who think they are, or their close family members are, victims of the criminal justice system, and they are often not entirely incorrect about that. So if you run as, yeah, I got screwed too, the man got me, you know, that's a pretty effective thing in that environment. I'm not so sure statewide that, you know, that trying to position yourself that way is all that effective.
Before we take a break, I just want to say Ryan, who had a very excellent question before, called us back to answer our question. And I think that this is right. We're going to double check this. Walt Woodward, if you're listening, state historian, you can back us up on this. Joe Bracken, back in the 1950s, was the last Republican attorney general, served from 1955 to 1959. He attended St. Peter's Parochial School, Hartford Public High School, graduated from Georgetown University Law School. I can read the rest of his bio to you during the break, Paz, if you'd like.
If Ryan didn't have to look that up, he needs to get outside and, you know.
And Ryan's prize is that John Dankosky will be recording a message on his answering machine.
Exactly. Please, Ryan, call back up. We'll set that up for you. We're talking with Mark Bazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Caitlin Krasselt from Hearst Connecticut Media, Colin McEnroe on the Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the rail lines. Yeah, the rails running from Springfield down to New Haven. How's it going so far? Also, sports betting coming and more casinos. We'll talk about that in the Wheelhouse right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Caitlin Krassold, who's a political reporter for Hearst Connecticut Media, Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Paz, you and I were on a panel last night up at New England Public Radio in Springfield. We were talking about the casino that is going to be going up there. Well, it's been going up. It's going to be opening in August. What impact that's going to have on the region, some of the other casino shenanigans that are happening around this state to try to force stall jobs and business going north to Springfield. But you brought up the idea that amidst all of this stuff, as we build brick and mortar casinos in Springfield and think about them in East Windsor or Bridgeport or wherever else, there's this new thing coming called sports gambling, probably on your phone, that is already there. And the more it becomes legal, the more it's going to change this entire world of gambling. Should we be talking more about sports betting than we were talking about these casinos?
Well, the numbers that are generated by casinos and by their lottery, quite frankly, certainly far, far swamp what you see on sports betting, which is a significant number. The estimate that I saw, I was invited to a seminar on sports betting in Stanford last week, and their best guess is that there's $600 million that's bet annually on sports in Connecticut, mainly through these offshore websites that the feds have taken various efforts to harass or shut down. But there's still a good number of them are there. Many of them have figured out how to get Visa and MasterCard to process their bills. Others, they you open an account, you put money in it, and then you bet against it. But it's here, and that's the argument for the state here and in other places to legalize it in the wake of the Supreme Court saying, sorry, Nevada, you no longer have exclusivity on sports betting.
And so where is the state government on that? Is the legislature working hard to make sure that we're going to capitalize on that, if indeed that's the right word to use?
Well, in Connecticut, this is always complicated because of the presence of two federally recognized tribes who have certain rights to provide gambling. So one of the issues is sports betting a casino game? Now, it's been offered at Nevada casinos for a long time. Does that make it a casino game? And if that's the case, the tribes have exclusive rights to it, and the state needs to negotiate with them the terms under which they can offer it through their off-track betting vendors and again, online. Because one of the things that was made crystal clear at this crash course on sports betting is if you're not online, don't bother doing it because, you know, you even in a state like Connecticut that does have a lot of OTB outlets, they're spread around the state. There are like 18 of them, and I think they're licensed to do another six. The real action, if you please, is online.
Colin, you have a thought on this?
Not an interesting thought. Although there is a social component to gambling, right? I mean, one of the reasons people go to casinos is there's a social component to all this. And you know, you think about incorporating a sports board into the casino, it's going to be a slightly different experience than just placing your bet online. I'll be interested to see how much of a handle there is here. I think there are a lot of people like me. I would have liked to bet on Mexico versus Germany, and I would have won too. but I don't really know how to do that. I'm not really interested in doing it illegally. You know, if it were made pretty easy for me to do it, I probably would do it. So, how much does the sort of casual person like me, and hopefully I'm not going to turn into some kind of addicted monster, how does that person react to a legal opportunity?
Is anybody talking about this? Because it's such a big issue, Caitlin, for the state to grapple with, are you talking to any political candidates who have any thoughts at all about where we're headed with sports betting, where we're heading with casinos, whether or not gambling is supposed to be a big part of how we, you know, balance the books here in the state?
That's another one of those interesting questions where people see it as a revenue opportunity, but they're also hesitant in some ways because there are a lot of other factors that play into it. Connecticut is a relatively small state, so when you'll hear a lot of the candidates talk about jobs competing for jobs in other places, and then you factor in sports betting and how does that play in. I think there's just a lot of questions, and so people bring it up, but
I think Stemmerman's plan does have paramutual Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes.
That's actually not true. I don't I don't think that's true.
It's the kind of nerd thing he would do.
Although I haven't read the plan that thoroughly. One thing I did say at our event last night, Paz, that I think is true is that, you know, Hartford right now is thinking of, you know, how do we keep people from leaving the state and going and spending money at this new MGM casino? There's going to be all these problems. We're going to lose jobs. We're going to lose revenue. People are going to go north. But meanwhile, we've just opened up a commuter rail on Connecticut's dime, in large part, in order to drive people on a train straight to Springfield. So, and that's just opened up. So we're providing this new opportunity for people. What do you see as the reality of this new Hartford line, Paz, as it opens up? We had the first opening weekend. Is this going to be a big deal for the state?
Well, I'll make a prediction that we're not going to have a lot of gamblers taking the train to Springfield.
Come on. I think we will.
I'm going to just put that out there right now. You know, it's funny. As you hear all the candidates talk, I'm struck over and over again by how often they sound like Dan Malloy, at least when they talk about what the state of Connecticut needs. And better mass transit, particularly through Fairfield County, always tops the list. People have bought into the idea that train service from Springfield to Hartford to New Haven and on to New York, particularly if you can get it to work a little bit faster south of New Haven than it currently is, that could be a game changer for the Connecticut economy. The day I drove down to that sports betting seminar in Stamford, I live in West Hartford. It took me close to 3 hours leaving my house at 6:30 in the morning to get to the Marriott in Stamford because of a variety of misadventures on, you know, various highways. But that's the normal commute for a lot of folks. It's 2 hours.
And you live in Fairfield County, Caitlin. I guess I'm just wondering how down there this new plan is viewed. You know, we're going to have a commuter rail line going up the spine of Connecticut, and the people in Fairfield County are like, hold it. The big problem is right here in our backyard where everything's jammed up, the roads are jammed up, and the trains don't run as fast as they should.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge topic of conversation down there. I spend a majority of my time sitting on I-95 or waiting for a train, whether I'm going into the city or I'm driving somewhere. So it's a huge issue in Fairfield County, not to, you know, go back to the topic of casinos, but that's one of the big topics that's come up is traffic. And so I think this commuter rail line can maybe move people out of Fairfield County because once you have access, you have growth in that direction. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that will maybe alleviate some of the problem as you get people moving, you know, along the rail line. But
there is this real split column because I think people in Fairfield County think of all of this stuff that's up here as, you know, it doesn't really matter. The important part, all the jobs and everything happening down there. I was just talking with some folks from the transit community in Boston. They actually look at the Hartford bus line, this the CT Fast Track, as a really interesting way of connecting rail and bus service. They see the commuter rail line as a way to connect New York and Boston. It's almost like the state is once again split between Fairfield County, which really thinks the problems are down there and they need to be solved down there, and the rest of the state and maybe the rest of New England that are thinking, some of these innovations around commuter rail and bus transit are going to make a big difference here over time.
I was thinking about CT Fast Track, too. And if you look inside the mind of the typical CT Fast Track hater, of which there are many, basically what you see is, well, it doesn't go directly from my house to the place I go every day. That's why I hate it. It's no good. And you can't think about mass transit that way. You have to think about mass transit as building capacity. And you have to be building capacity all the time in lots of places. Now, until we did CT Fast Track, our mass transit capacity, the active lines in Connecticut, were basically the same ones that Pete Campbell was using to get back and forth to his job in Mad Men. You know, I mean, we really just didn't really build capacity. And you have to do a lot of it. And if you do a lot of it, if you do enough of it, ultimately, yeah, the people who are feeling left out or at least unduly, you know, handled this time around will eventually feel better. And, you know, if you can take a little bit of the capacity off the north-south corridor, it will affect stuff down on 95 too, because people are going to take a train trip maybe from here to Norwalk instead of driving.
Well, and I will say, just a very quick report for you. Our producer, Carmen Baskoff, who works on Where We Live, has been taking this train from New Haven to work here every day this week. She says it's on time. The electronic sign's not working quite right yet. Of course, the bathrooms aren't working. Can't take a bike on it yet, but it's pretty cheap. It seems to be pretty convenient, and she's liking this train travel. Maybe we'll update with her coming
up. Of course, we're giving her IV electrolytes now because she hasn't been able to drink water all day.
Thanks to Colin McEnroe. Thanks to Caitlin Krasold from Hearst, and thanks to Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. This is The Wheelhouse.